I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Mike Clark of the Los Angeles-based band Final Gravity. Formed in 2007, the quartet adds a hard-edged sound to a progressive rock bass that comes to the fore on the 2024 effort Storm Chaser, which was produced by Rich Mauser, known for his work with Tears for Fears, Transatlantic, Spock's Beard, and many others. The recording also features a cover of the Rush classic, Entre Nous, and Mike Clark and myself talk a little bit about his love of Rush and my own on this episode of Into Music. That's a conversation with Mike Clark of Final Gravity coming up now. When did this kind of start? Is this sort of like a thing where the band's kind of always talking about, okay, we finished one thing, what are we going to do next? Or is this like, you know, it just feels like it's time to do something?
We'd worked for a while on an album that came out in 2021 called Surviving Humanity. And some of those songs we've been working on for significant amount of time and kind of got delayed further by COVID, but finally came around and put that album out. Did some shows to support it. And then we kind of after that, we said, well, we've been working on this material for a while. Let's write all new songs. And we spent a while kind of working on all these new songs. And after a while, our drummer, John, who owns a recording studio, ended up getting a friend of his to come down and basically engineer us for a day and sort of produce us recording the song Planet Earth that now closes out Storm Chaser. And we were really happy with the results of it. We did some overdubs, but you know, a lot of what is in the song was kind of recorded in a single day long session with Chris Henry, who engineered it. So we thought, okay, well, we've got this really good recording and we've always wanted to work with a guy named Rich Mauser, who ended up being the producer and mixer on the album overall. So we went up and took the song up to Rich. And he did a fantastic job mixing it. And we actually got to go up to his studio, the Mouse House, which he's mixed a lot of like great progressive rock albums like Transatlantic. He's worked with Spock's Beard, bands like that. So we were really happy with the mix and kind of decided after that, well, we have a band that we're friends with in the LA area named Lobate Scarp. And they'd actually had Rich produce a couple other albums. We thought, well, he did a great job with them. He's got this great pedigree with progressive rock and he did a great job mixing Planet Earth. So we kind of got the idea of, well, why don't we go and try to do an EP and we'll take a few of our older songs. We took a little break from the writing new material and let's maybe take a few of our other older songs in addition to Planet Earth and work with Rich on them and kind of put out the EP, clear the decks of that and then get back to the writing project. So we ended up doing kind of pre-production sessions with Rich on three of the songs that are on the album, The Deep, Far Away, and Story of Forever. And we're really happy with that. And so we ended up booking out a week to go and just kind of record and, you know, really do the majority of the backing or the bass tracks, drum, bass, guitar within a 1 week period, laid some vocals down, laid some keyboard down. It was sort of intended to be kind of a detour, like let's, you know, do the CP, get something out there, and then we'll kind of get back to writing new material. That process ended up taking a lot longer than we thought. So that was probably about, you know, a few fits and starts, but probably about a 1 year process between like when we did Planet Earth and when we actually got the Storm Chaser EP kind of mixed and ready to go. So yeah, it was sort of a little side trip. We're really happy with the results of it and learned a lot from that process that as we're writing new material, we're kind of bringing in there and intend to, you know, create something that sounds equally good, but have newer songs on it.
Yeah. Just to talk about Rich, of course, he lost the studio in the fires. Right. And that was, I don't know the man, but I've talked to so many people over the years who have worked with him and it's that case of like, he's not just good at what he does, but he's also a good person. And I think that for a lot of the music community made that sort of thing even a little bit tougher.
Yeah, really, really great guy. Really just, I mean, great musician in addition to being a producer. You know, I think sometimes you have people who are more engineer producers who can get you to sound great. Rich was very good at kind of honing in and saying, no, you need to make that guitar part a little tighter. Let's make sure we kind of fix the pitch on this. So master kind of engineer, mixer and everything, but really good at getting those basic tracks laid down so that he has great material to work with. And I think that, you know, one of the most heartbreaking things that, you know, my observation is that you know, Rich had a very intimate, long-standing relationship with that room, the control room in the Mouse House. And, you know, he has all kinds of vintage gear that he collected over, you know, literally a few decades. I'll give you an example. There's a middle part of our song, Far Away. There's this sort of like pentatonic riff in drop D that kind of, we have this like groovy part that goes into a guitar solo afterward. Rich has, or sorry, had a rack-mountable device called a Cooper Time Cube that was, I think, built in the 70s. And it was intended to kind of do like very short slapback delay. And the way it worked back then, it was actually, they would, it's almost like a talk box, you know, used by guitar, like Peter Frampton used it back in the day. They run a little speaker. They would put the audio signal through a garden hose and then have a microphone at the other end. And the system, I guess, had two lengths of garden hose that could either be combined for a longer slapback or separated for kind of a dual layered approach. And I always saw the unit in Rich's room, but I didn't think he ever used it. And I asked him one point, it's like, hey, Rich, have you ever used that Cooper Time Cube? It's like, yeah, I used it on The Deep. I've used it on Neil Morse's vocals from Spock's Beard. It was like, so, I mean, all the gear in there, even though a lot of it was like from the 70s or, you know, but he just had this great connection with it. It really was a signature part of his sound. So I think the really difficult thing for him is going to be, I'm sure he can, you know, go into a new studio and do great, but it'll be like kind of relearning, you know, how to do it with different gear because he was just so tied to that for so long.
So you have this. Now this project that, you know, you said it was, you know, kind of a detour and it took longer and everything like that. But is this one of those things where it's like, no matter that, the setbacks or whatever, it actually in the long run probably took the exact right amount of time because the process ultimately was worth it in the end.
Yeah, I think there's some element of that. I mean, maybe we had a couple of delays in there that were not really advancing us forward. It's just kind of scheduling, you know, between us and Rich and everything. But I think that a lot of it was, it did kind of take time for it to marinate, take time for these songs to kind of evolve. You know, we did have to go back at a few points and kind of, you know, lay some additional parts down. And I think the end result absolutely was worth it. So no, I think that's a fair point. I think that, you know, it took as long as it took.
Tell me about, I have to ask, being it's so funny because before I got on here, I was exchanging text messages from an old school friend of mine who lives in Chicago now, and he's buying these Canadian pressings of the early Rush albums, and he just keeps on sending me photos. So you know where this is going. Tell me about the Rush cover.
Well, I mean, Rush is my favorite band, and I think probably, I know Charles, our bass player, it's his favorite band. I think John, it's either number one or number two, depending on his mood. we're a bit into Rush. We've been maybe accused of sounding a little bit like Rush at points. during COVID, what we were doing, one of the things we did is we did four, you know, those kind of lockdown videos that a lot of bands did. And the first one we did was in probably the first half of 2020. And unfortunately, you know, Neil Peart died in January of 2020. And, you know, I kind of thought that was going to be the worst thing that would happen all year. And then COVID hit. It was a pretty awful year, but we wanted to do kind of a little, you know, tribute to Neil. So we did a recording of Limelight, and Charles put together a great video. And we even had a little, you know, McAllen toast because the McAllen was Neil Peart's favorite scotch. So, you know, we did pretty well with Limelight. Sounded good. We ended up doing like a Zeppelin cover of The Ocean before that. And then we did a cover of Revolution Calling by Queensryche after Limelight. And then we decided we're going to do a fourth. And I think I'm the one who suggested Entre Nous because I've always loved that song. And it wasn't so intricate that it would take forever for us to kind of put it together. You know, we were basically doing like, you know, in our respective spaces, we just put the camera on, record it, our audio would go right to Pro Tools, and then we basically combined it all together for the video. So we didn't want to do something where we'd have to do like, you know, 100 takes to lock all our parts together. So yeah, we recorded it. I think from doing the three prior videos, I think we'd started to dial the process in a little bit. I think each of us kind of had our best individual recordings when we worked on that. And kind of put it all together, sounded really good. Charles did another great video for it. And we put that on YouTube probably late 2020, and it got by far the most views of any of those four videos. And I think we were also added by the fact that another kind of, a Rush tribute band actually did their own cover of Entre Nous, and YouTube started to, we were being recommended to each other. Like if you liked Final Gravity's, version of Entre Nous, go check out, I forget if it was Why Not or I think it was Why Not, but either way, yeah, we kind of like, I think, benefited from each other's traffic. So it was interesting that what we put out on YouTube was pretty much just, you know, John mixed it, did a good job with it. But toward the end of us working with Rich, you know, John said, hey, if you got a couple of hours, here's some tracks from Entre Nous. Could you maybe run it through your gear and kind of try to give it the same sound as like everything else? And so Rich did. I think he only, you know, was able to devote a couple hours to it, but we mixed it. And yeah, I mean, it's like the drums sounded much bigger and, you know, kind of in line with what he'd recorded. Ran it through his, you know, effects. And, you know, one cool thing that Rich always did is he'd master everything to reel tape to get kind of that warmth and natural compression on there. So he did all that, and it's like it really kind of brought it up to a, you know, higher level. And when we heard it in conjunction with everything else on the album, it was recorded much, much differently, but, you know, it holds up. So we were very happy with it.
So I have to ask, I mean, so I'm 52, and for me, Rush was kind of like that. I think what was appealing about them was that there was that musicianship, but that accessibility. And there wasn't a lot of music like that at the time. So was that kind of it for you, like you were starting to learn how to play or something, and you were like, oh, well, this is this is something I can really sink into because there's challenge here and that sort of thing?
So I started playing guitar back in 1983, and I think around that period I was like you know, really getting into actually I had about a year before that where I was like really getting into like new wave and alternative stuff. We have a station out here in LA called K-Rock that I was listening to a lot back then. And then suddenly I started playing guitar and it became more like, oh, well, you know, Led Zeppelin and, you know, more like classic rock. But another, you know, radio thing we had out here in LA was there's a station called KLOS, and they would do a thing called The Seventh Day where they'd actually play entire albums like late at night. And, you know, back when cassette tape was a thing, you know, the thing to do would be put your cassette tape on and record the album and play it on your Walkman. So I guess I'm dating myself quite a bit here, but it was cool. So they played the album Exit Stage Left from Rush, and I did exactly that. I recorded it and I listened to it, and I like got really almost obsessed with it. I'm like, this is like the most cool, epic sounding stuff. And you know, you're right. It was progressive, but not like, I mean, it was accessible. It was kind of, you know, had just a great, great feel to it. So after a few weeks of listening to that, I'm like just starting to buy all their albums, listening to them. And like, I was totally hooked. And of course, you know, was practicing all their stuff on guitar, learning as much as I could. So became a pretty, pretty big obsession for a while there.
Did that kind of help you sort of realize like, okay, then I'm really committed to music because I can execute these kinds of things and I've really found something that I'm engaged with?
Yeah, I think so. I think there were two things. So working on the Rush material and other more complex rock or other progressive rock, I mean, definitely made me feel good that after, you know, a sufficient amount of time of getting competent on guitar, I was able to play some of it. I also ended up studying with a jazz guitar teacher and performer out in LA, a guy named Jeff Richmond. So not that I got super serious about like kind of jazz and fusion, but it was kind of cool getting a little more of that musical sophistication of, you know, being able to kind of, you know, play more sophisticated jazz chords and play over changes a little bit. And I think the combination of the two really, I think, boosted my confidence in terms of my, you know, ability to play music.
And also that the 80s was kind of that time of having skill, having facility. It was like that was okay. It was actually preferred.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the cool thing with Jeff, I mean, he ended up, you know, he had some albums out even back then. And looking back, you know, there's a jazz club in Santa Monica, just a few blocks from where I am right now. And he would play there. And I mean, he'd have guys like, I think he played it. I know he played on his albums, but I think he played a couple of shows with like Vinnie Caliuta on drums. He had Gary Willis on bass, who played with, you know, Alan Holdsworth. There's one show I went to, again, not too far from here. He had Ralph Humphrey on drums, who played with Zappa, and he's another legendary drummer. So it's like, you know, not only skill, but I think also just being in LA and having this like incredible pool of musicians, and then, you know, having a guitar teacher kind of was a little bit of an entry into that world. And I remember, like, you know, there were guitar magazines like Guitar for the Practicing Musician, where every month they'd have like multiple transcriptions of, you know, you name it, like killer solos. And it was like not only okay, it was like really desired for at least, you know, the kind of crowds that I was in.
How did you all find each other for this band? Because, you know, part of putting together a band is that you have common musical interests and so forth. But that's not always easy to do. So was this something where it fell into place fairly quickly, or?
Well, I guess like there's sort of maybe two connections to go through me that kind of led to the lineup that we have, or at least the original lineup we had. So I had a childhood friend, again, out here in Santa Monica. We went to elementary school together and really became good friends in junior high as I started playing. He was playing piano since he was like 6 years old and got really good. And so we ended up kind of playing together and even had a band back when we were like in, you know, eighth grade or whatever, like when, you know, around when I started playing. So he ended up actually moving out to Philadelphia, but we, you know, kept in touch and we visited each other and everything. So Steve, you know, my friend, ended up going to Penn State University and ended up forming a band out there. And the band featured our drummer, John, on drums, and then Bill Moore, our original lead vocalist. So in, about halfway through their time in college, I ended up flying out there and we decided, okay, well, their band's going to play like this big house party, but maybe let's do like a 30-minute set of me kind of playing with the band. And I think we actually played La Via Strangiato from Rush. We played like a Satriani tune. We played Hush from Deep Purple. So we kind of whipped all this together in like about a 4 or 5 day period and played this house party. When John and Bill graduated, Bill ended up moving out to LA because he was basically a scientist, got into UCLA for his master's degree and ultimately got his PhD from there. So he moved out here and kind of crashed with me for a while. We became roommates. And then maybe about 6 months to a year later, John moved out as well. So we let him crash with us. And then John got a job as a recording engineer at a really cool studio out in Hollywood. So we started to kind of record together and, you know, play music out there. So that's sort of how I like to hook up with those guys. And we actually did an album together. Our first album had Bill on vocals, and it was sort of like just a longstanding thing where we played together and then we formed Final Gravity, got back in like 2006. And that led to that album that came out in 2009. The other connection was Charles, our bass player. So I got sufficiently serious about music where I did classical guitar performances undergrad, but I did spend a year going to Musicians Institute out in Hollywood for their guitar program. And one day I'm like looking at the bulletin board and I see a guitarist wanted, influences Rush, King's X. I'm like, well, Rush is my favorite band and I love King's X, and I didn't know other people had heard of him. And so I called Charles, who was the poster. You know, we became friends out there and started to kind of, you know, play together in bands out at MI. And then once John and Bill kind of came out, which is, you know, a couple of years after Charles and I met, that's when we all connected, and eventually that led to Final Gravity.
So in that 2006 era, this was also a kind of fairly fertile time for progressive music, because there had been that sort of like renaissance of it in the late 90s and everything. I'm assuming at that point there were like people who were willing to hear it and so forth, whereas maybe 10 years earlier might have been a different scenario.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I'm not doing music as a full-time profession. I kind of ended up going into computers, like doing like data engineering, data architecture. So when I first got into that, I almost stopped playing for a couple of years because it just felt really frustrating. Like, you know, I got these music degrees and nobody seems to want to hear progressive rock. And so I'm like, okay, I'll just, you know, do my professional thing. And then, I remember there were actually two things that kind of got me back into it. And interestingly, one of them was I had a colleague. I was working at a company called MediaBase where I helped build the system where it was like tracking music that got played on the radio. And we did, you know, charts kind of like along the lines of Billboard. We were actually a competitor to like Billboard and that ilk. So my colleague, you know, got a lot of promos and he's like, hey, Mike, you got to check this out. It's this band and they're doing a really cool cover of Procol Harum song. I'm like, okay. So it turned out to be Transatlantic that Rich Mauser mixed that album. And I liked the Procol Harum cover. It was called In Hell Twas I. But the opening track is called All of the Above. And it's like 30 minutes long. And you know, it's almost like seems very influenced by things like Close to the Edge by Yes and everything, but with some Beatlesque things and just, you know, everything but the kitchen sink in there. So I put that on. I just like, okay, wow, this is cool. And I think that is one of the things that actually got me back and wanting to play music, because it got me really excited about it. And then from that, I discovered like Spock's Beard and some other, you know, the prog bands from that era. And then the other was Porcupine Tree. Actually, that same colleague got me a promo of In Absentia, which is the first album that has like Gavin Harrison on drums. And it was when they started to get more kind of, you know, prog and metal and everything. And I think Charles simultaneously kind of lobbied me to like get into Porcupine Tree. And I think between Porcupine Tree and Transatlantic, I'm like, okay, there is exciting new progressive rock coming out. There is an audience for it. And I think that made me start picking up the guitar again and kind of, you know, recording with those guys again.
Yeah. Good for you. Because yeah, it's tough when you feel like, man, what did I do all this for? And then you find, oh, it's back. You know, it never left me. It was just like out of the room for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, it was back in a different form. I mean, I think back in the glory days. I mean, I guess the glory days were really even before my time, back in the 70s, where, you know, going to see Rush, you know, they would typically play the Forum here in LA. In fact, I just happened to see the last show that Rush ever did. They did their final show at the Forum here in Los Angeles. So my first and last Rush show were both there. So, you know, I mean, it's definitely not, you're not seeing a whole lot of progressive rock in like, you know, 18,000 seat arenas anymore, but, you know, it is still, you know, doing well. Like bands like Dream Theater, I'm going to go see them in a couple of weeks. They're playing at the YouTube Theater. And that's a 5,000 seater. So, you know, there is still some hope for Prague.
Well, and the funny thing too, is that that period was sort of like when I started writing music reviews and stuff. And I was writing about a lot of that music, and the fans were just so like, they liked Prague and that's what they liked. And so it's like, whatever it was, if it was Prague, that was the, they were all in. Do you find that it's kind of still that way, that there's like that loyalty among the progressive fans?
Oh yeah. No, I think so. I mean, I'll go to shows out here, and I think one of the most recent shows where this happened was, the 80s era of King Crimson. They did kind of a tribute tour where it was like Tony Levin and Adrian Belew from that lineup, and then they had Steve Vai on guitar and Danny Carey from Tool on drums. And they basically did a tour, and pretty much everything, all but one song they played, I think, was from those three albums, you know, Discipline, Beat, and Three of a Perfect Pair. And I bumped into a few people I'd never met before, and it's just like, you know, it's like, did you go to this show? Yeah. Did you go to that show? Yeah. I remember seeing, you know, King Crimson on the Thrack tour at the Wiltern. Yeah, I was there too. And so I think there's that very much that connection. Like even people you don't know, there's like this maybe Prague gene or something that we all have that non-Prague people don't.
You've been listening to a conversation with Mike Clark of the Los Angeles-based band Final Gravity. Final Gravity's latest release is Storm Chaser. You can find out more about the entire Final Gravity catalog via the band's Bandcamp page, and stream their music on a variety of platforms as well. And we want to take a moment to say that our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. We do welcome your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org, and encourage you to see all of our programs at kmuw.org. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.